Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker and Brown offices in Montpelier and Lennonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us on the program today. Vermont Digger's Ann Galloway, 7 Days political editor Paul Heinz, and WCAX reporter Alex Apple will all join us to take in some of the and talk about some of the important stories in Vermont this week. We'll also check in with our colleagues live from D.C. at Talk Media News, and then it's Free for All Friday. It's in essence where I turn the program over to you, our listeners, and you can call in on any subject that's important to you. Tell us why your subject is important. So call in on Free for All Friday. Packed program today, so let's get started. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Vermont Digger's Ann Galloway. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Mike.
And Vermont Digger is suing the state, asking the court to release EB-5 emails. What are these emails that you seek?
Yes, they're documents that USCIS, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, has sent to the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. This summer, the federal government asked some questions about the oversight of JPEEK and about the management of the Vermont EB-5 Regional Center. And this information has been blocked to the press. The Burlington Free Press also asked for a letter and a list of questions that USCIS sent the state. The state has refused to release that letter. It has also refused to release its response to the questions that were asked. And it's not known at this time what the status of the EB-5 Center is in Vermont. It's possible that the federal government said you're doing everything perfectly and you've got a clean bill of health, or it's possible that they may have temporarily suspended the center or even taken action to begin terminating it, and we would have no idea because the Agency of Commerce and Community Development has refused to talk about it and has refused to release crucial email communications and official communication.
Are these emails wrapped up into the entire sort of package that the Attorney General is holding now, or are they elsewhere in state government?
That's right. The reason that state officials say they can't release the documents is because there's something called a litigation hold exemption in the Public Records Act that allows them to block public access. And Bill Sorrell, the Vermont Attorney General, put this litigation hold in place in October of 2015, about 6 months before the Securities and Exchange Commission brought charges against Ariel Quiros and Bill Stenger, the developers of the resort. And he has refused to provide that letter to the press, so I don't know exactly when it was issued to state agencies, but my understanding is Sorrell told certain state agencies that they were not to release any records related to the EB-5 program, and yet in the months of November, December, through April 8th, actually, 4 days before the SEC charges were brought, I requested records and received records from the Department of Financial Regulation and the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. So not knowing what the letter said, I don't know why these particular documents were released regarding the construction of the Burke Hotel, while others were not. And subsequent attempts to get information, we sought emails between Alex McLean, the former chief of staff for Governor Peter Shumlin, and Bill Stenger, who later became her boss at JPEEK, were blocked because of the litigation hold. And we also sought communications between Senator Patrick Leahy's office and the state regarding EB-5, and those email, that email, that request for the emails or other correspondence was also rejected.
But in this case, Anne, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on it. In this case, it's a specific request for a specific document. It's not the entire email hold that you're having. And again, the document relates to how the EB-5 program is performing here in Vermont, an assessment from the federal government. Am I correct in that?
Yes, that's right. The lawsuit is focused on that issue. I'm just giving you and your listeners some background on other requests we've made. But yes, the lawsuit is focused on this particular matter that we believe is crucial for people to understand, because at this time, the public doesn't know what the status of the EB-5 Center is, and our case basically says that Sorrell is trying to wall off an entire program in state government, and that's an overly broad interpretation of the litigation hold exemption.
Let's go to the broader question. When will all these emails be released?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I mean, they have 20 days to respond, and so I expect that they'll probably try to dismiss our case in court. And so I don't have any way of knowing the answer to that question, certainly well after the election. And I think that at this point, you know, we're going to go ahead and start discovery next week. So we're on it. We actually got word yesterday that the Vermont ACLU will act as our local counsel, and that means that our attorney, Tim Cornell, who's a very expert litigator, will be litigating the case, and so we're going to be getting rolling with it next week.
Has the AG given any sort of time frame on when they may lift this litigation hold on all the emails, not only these emails that we're talking about, but all the emails, the ones that you've requested previously to this, as well as these?
Yes, well, he said that everything could be made available after the litigation is complete, and I've been told by numerous people that litigation could take 5 years.
It'll be interesting where we go from here. Let's open up the broader question in terms of this EB-5 program. Where are we now with the court case against Ariel Quiros and the freezing of his assets?
Well, last week, the judge agreed to only allow Quiros $80,000 for expenses he's incurred for attorney's fees. He had asked for $1.6 million, so that was a pretty big slap in the face. And then earlier this week, Michael Goldberg, the court-appointed receiver, asked to seize, and the judge granted this request, Ariel Quiros' personal laptop, because Michael Goldberg believes that Ariel Quiros was conducting JPEEK business on a personal email account. Mm-hmm. And you know, again, the trial, should it occur, would be at least a year from now. And at this point, we don't even have a decision from the judge on the preliminary injunction. So that could happen any day, actually, that decision. But, of course, we've been saying that for months.
Now, there's been a lot going on since we last spoke. Bill Stenger has settled with the SEC. Is he out of the woods, or is there still something that he's got to be worried about on this this investigation?
Well, the big fish that the SEC is going after is Ariel Quiros. And the settlement basically ends their dealings with Stenger per se, except that he may testify against Quiros at some point, and he continues to cooperate with the federal authorities. Stenger does potentially face criminal charges. There is a criminal investigation underway. Again, that could be charges could be a year out on that, and Stenger also could be charged with additional civil counts by the state, and so that's all pending. I have no idea how that's going to proceed, really.
Since the last time we spoke, Citibank settled with the receiver, Michael Goldberg, with a sum of about $13.3 million. I'm a little confused. What was Citibank's exposure, and why did they settle?
They had they hosted a couple of bank accounts for Kairos's companies, and Kairos put $17 million in these two bank accounts, and then immediately took out loans against the money in the accounts, and the SEC and Michael Goldberg have accused Citibank of essentially allowing him to potentially launder funds that way.
Mm-hmm.
But Citibank didn't admit to any wrongdoing there, and that's why they settled. And the $13 million is to be used for various purposes at JPEEK.
One of those purposes is to pay property tax, from what I'm reading, because the resort hasn't paid its property tax. Is that correct?
That's right. They owed $2 million to the town of Jay, which we reported on earlier this week. And when we called Michael Goldberg, he said that he would pay on those taxes within a month. He has to get court approval for all of the payments that are made out of the settlement. And he also still owes money on the repair to the tram, which is essential to the resort's operations. There are vendors who are owed about $5 million. And then, of course, the contractors at Burke and at the stateside condos and ANC Bio are all owed money. And that totals about $6 million also. So if you tally it all up, he needs to come up with about $18 million. And plus, he needs to operate the resort. So the $13 million at Citibank doesn't quite cut it. I think he's hoping to sell the hole in Newport sometime soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's also building up as much of a reserve as he possibly can from operations at the two resorts.
Is there? We've talked about Citibank. Obviously, there was another financial institution that settled earlier. Are there any other financial institutions under investigation that, or in settlement talks that we know of? Or actually, that you know of?
Well, sure. Well, Raymond James settled an administrative fee case with the state, but they're still being sued in a class action by the investors.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Goldberg has glommed onto that, too. So that's still out there, and it's possible that Raymond James could settle at some point. That case hasn't really moved much lately, but we are keeping an eye on it.
And just where an update on the investors. Remember the last time we talked, the investors, they were worried that immigration and customs and immigration was not going to give them any relief because of the requirements in order to get a green card. Any updates on the investors?
Their status has not changed because Senator Patrick Leahy and Michael Goldberg were not able to get a loophole approved by Congress before the deadline, September 30th. So there was a temporary extension of the EB-5 program, and reforms will be taken up again, I expect, in December. But Republicans in the House and the Senate oppose new restrictions that would be placed on developers for financial transparency and that kind of thing. So it will be a bit of a fight to rein in the program as Senator Leahy wants, and part of his reforms include this exemption essentially for investors who have been caught in fraud cases like this around the country.
And going back to your lawsuit, what can we expect in the next few weeks? You'll have discovery, a court hearing. What happens now that you've filed suit?
Well, I think that as it unfolds, we'll be reporting on it. But yes, we will file some discovery questions next week. We'll expect answers quickly. I think that in the past, judges have been very good about making sure that these cases are dealt with fairly quickly. But the state does have 20 days to respond. And we filed last week. So it could be a few weeks.
Ann Galloway, as always, thank you so much for being on Open Mic this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
Ann Galloway from Vermont Digger coming up. Paul Hines, 7 days political editor, will be talking about various things that happened in the state politically, because guess what? It's 11 days to the election, and all things are political right now in terms of a lot of news happening in this state and in this nation. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to the Open Mic program Paul Hines, who's the 7 days political editor. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
I am fine. Thank you very much for asking. Let's start out by following the money in the governor's race, because there's a lot of it, and you've done a very good job at sort of sifting through it. Let's talk Vermonters for first.
Sure.
Vermonters are throwing big money at the campaign. Why?
Well, because they got it, I guess, in some cases. What I did this week in my column was I tried to get a sense of which individual donors were spending the most in Vermont politics this election cycle. We hear a lot about out-of-state money coming in, and to be clear, there is a lot of out-of-state money coming in, and we'll talk about that in a second, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that.
But, here in Vermont, what I wanted to do is calculate who were the biggest donors, individual donors, family donors. So I sifted through all the state election files for the last 2 years and the federal election files, found that there were 28 different people and families who have contributed more than $20,000 to either a Vermont political candidate, a party, a super PAC that's operating the state, or some other entity like that. So this excludes things like Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, but it does include Patrick Leahy's reelection campaign, both political parties, et cetera. First of all, I was surprised that there were that many people who'd spent so much money. The other thing that was a little surprising about it is that most of the people who donated that much actually live in Vermont. All but three either live full-time or mostly full-time here. A lot of the names will be familiar. By far and away, the biggest individual donor to these elections is an exception to the rule. He's a guy who lives in San Francisco. And made basically just three contributions. His name is Reid Hoffman. He's a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, and he's the guy who dumped $220,000 into Matt Dunn's campaign just about a week before the August primary. And to be clear, he didn't actually contribute the money to the campaign. He himself bought $220,000 of TV ads. But beyond that, most of these donors are sort of in the $20,000 to $100,000 range. The two biggest donors who actually live in Vermont are David Blittersdorf on the Democratic side, of course, a very prominent renewable energy developer, and Skip Valley on the Republican side, and he is a gasoline distributor, retailer, owns the Maplefields gas stations. So those are some of the bigger names that I saw here.
And You probably did this, Paul, and I just can't remember. I did read your column.
I hope you did, Mike.
did you add up what the total amount was on this?
Of all of those people?
All those people.
Yes. What was it? It was like, I want to say that it was, of those 28 people, it was like 1.2 or 1.3 million.
Okay.
Because about 880,000 of the mega donors gave to Democrats. 482,000 went to Republicans. So there's definitely a disparity there, although there are a number of very wealthy Republican donors here as well. One of the things I found, which I thought was fairly interesting, is the different ways that you can give this much money, because, of course, state law prevents you from donating more than $4,000 to a political candidate. So how exactly can you spend that much money? One way is the way that David Blittersdorf does it, which is he gives a ton of money to the Vermont Democratic Party in $10,000 batches personally and through various businesses he controls, which is allowed. And then he also gives to super PACs. But someone like Skip Valley I think his biggest contribution was $4,000, but he spread his among a whole lot of state legislative candidates. So I want to say he gave like 60 or 65 different small contributions all across the state. So it's pretty interesting the way that you can spend your money here if you put your mind to it.
So let's turn out of state now. The RGA and the DGA are throwing big money as well into this state, really big money. This is a very expensive governor's race. What are they spending?
Well, to start with the top line, the RGA is hugely outspending the DGA, at least on its own super PAC. So throughout this campaign, the RGA has spent $2.4 million on ads supporting Phil Scott, while the DGA has only spent about $814,000, so about a third as much, supporting Sue Minter. But it gets a little bit more complicated beyond that, because those groups are not just spending money on their own ads. So what the DGA has done recently is it's pumped a ton of money into these Planned Parenthood ads that you're probably seeing on the air. And so while those ads have Planned Parenthood's name all over it, Planned Parenthood, the political branch of the organization, only gave about $50,000 to run those ads. But the DGA contributed $350,000 to the Planned Parenthood super PAC. So these are really DGA ads that you're seeing. They just look like something different on TV.
In the WPTZ debate, both Minter and Scott were given the opportunity to disavow the negative ads. Scott obliged, Minter didn't. Does that have any impact on an election?
I don't think it has as much of an impact on election as the ads themselves, because, you know, how many people watch the WPTZ debate versus how many people are seeing these ads day in and day out? You know, there's a reason why. I mean, everyone says they hate political ads, but they work. And they work because they're repeated over and over again. You're just drilling this message into people's heads. And with the, you know, with this Planned Parenthood ad, it is a really tough ad. You know, Phil Scott, understandably, and his allies have some real problems with these ads, because they accuse him of being against abortion. And he considers himself pro-choice. Now, the ad, I should say, is actually based on 7Day's own reporting, and it is one of those ads that is literally true, because Phil Scott has supported certain restrictions on a woman's right to choose. For instance, late-term abortions he's opposed, and he has sought rules requiring parental notification in some cases. So he has literally supported some restrictions on a woman's right to choose. But he has also said throughout his political career that he considers himself pro-choice, that he supports Roe v. Wade. So I think there's a real division in how people view this, and whether it's fair to say that Scott is against abortion, whether it's fair to say he's pro-choice. It's a touchy subject.
Bernie is giving Minter and Zuckerman access to his list and also touring around the state with them. Is that going to have an impact?
Well, you know, I think when we talked last about this, I said that, you know, a late-day endorsement on a Thursday afternoon from Bernie Sanders doesn't mean much, but if he really uses the tools at his disposal to campaign for Sue Minter, it could have a real impact. And, you know, the tools at his disposal he is using. He spent all last weekend campaigning with Sue up and down the western side of the state. This weekend, it's the eastern side of the state. And as you note, he's sent out a fundraising solicitation to his enormous list for both Minter and David Zuckerman. Now, we don't know how much money has actually come in. Zuckerman told me a few hours after the email sent that he had already picked up $20,000 from small donors. Surely that number is far higher right now. But it seems to me that Bernie is really actually walking the walk on this one. He is doing all of the things that he can do to help out Sue Minter. The only thing that's left, I think, for him to do, which I wouldn't be surprised if he did do, is for him to appear in a TV ad himself, really heartily endorsing Sue Minter. I think that could have, also a very big effect, just as these things probably are having an effect.
The two lieutenant gubernatorial candidates, Randy Brock and David Zuckerman, debated this week. And the only thing I think new that came out of that debate was an apology by Zuckerman over a 2013 tape where he seems to criticize the Vermont National Guard. That's generated a lot of phone calls here, by the way.
Right.
Will it have any impact on the election?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's I always hate answering that question because it's impossible to say. Who the heck knows? You know, this has been a really negative campaign, you know, far more negative, really, than even the gubernatorial campaign. Gotten less attention, but, you know, it's been a rough one, especially for Randy Brock. I mean, he's really been going after David Zuckerman. And this video, I think, it's pretty rough for David Zuckerman. You know, he's definitely minimizing the contribution of the Vermont National Guard, which, you know, I feel like no matter where you are in the political spectrum, it's kind of a tough argument to make. And I think he recognized that. I think that's why he apologized so quickly. I don't have a real sense so much of how much this is resonating. Certainly the CAX poll that came out earlier this week confirmed that Zuckerman had a big lead, and you know, but it's always hard to know whether this kind of thing will move that.
Anything else in that CAX poll that surprised you this week?
Well, you know, I don't know if surprise is the right word, because we just don't have enough polling here in the state. So when it happens, it's you know, I'm always quite happy about it, but you have to be a little bit careful about drawing too many conclusions, because we don't have a good baseline, we don't have tracking polls here, we don't have a way to sort of measure things up and down. The CX poll did differ significantly, well, a bit from the VPR poll that came out a little bit earlier, a week earlier, in that the CX poll showed Phil Scott with a lead on the outside of the margin of error, or right on the edge of the margin of error, 47-40%, whereas the VPR poll showed it a statistical tie. So what we don't know is whether CX's methodology was a little bit different than VPR's, and maybe that accounts for the difference. Or is it because the CX poll was taken a week or two later, and does that show some movement toward Phil Scott? I don't think we can really say at this point, but certainly you'd rather have you'd rather be Phil Scott with a 47-40% lead in one poll than Sue Minter.
The ads themselves in the governor's race, as you mentioned earlier, they're coming fast and furious. But one ad for Sue Minter features the president. This is something that we've never seen. Well, it's been rare in this state where a president will cut a radio ad for a candidate.
Yeah, it's definitely rare in our state. And sometimes this is rare because you know, presidents typically aren't all that popular. I mean, it's unusual to see a president leaving office with as high an approval rating as President Obama has, surely much higher here in Vermont. This isn't that rare across the country, though. Right now, Obama has he's recorded a ton of radio ads, a ton of TV ads for, you know, most Democratic candidates up and down the ballot. So, you know, this isn't really a unique thing for Sue Minter. But here in Vermont, you know, a listener wouldn't necessarily know that. It sounds like the president is coming in and really validating this Democratic candidate. You know, I think one question here is, stepping back a little bit, how much an effect do all these validators have? Because Sue has them all, right? She's got the president. She had the vice president visiting last week and having breakfast with her. She's got Bernie Sanders campaigning up and down the state. The Vermont Democratic put out a web ad. Vermont Democratic Party put out a web ad yesterday with Leahy really making the case for Sue Minter. She's got all these people really backing her, and Phil Scott doesn't have any of these people because they don't exist in the Republican Party right now. There's no real national figure in the Republican Party that would be very popular in Vermont. The only one I can think of might be like John McCain, and he's a little busy trying to get reelected out in Arizona right now. You know, the only person in state, I think, with that kind of cachet is Jim Douglas, your old boss, who I think Phil has deployed well. But it's hard, you know, when it's Jim Douglas versus Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, you know, it's hard to match.
What's interesting is out of all the names that you named, guess the name that is not in all of these sort of ads.
Your friend Donald Trump?
Well, that would be one.
That would be one.
How about Governor Shumlin?
That is true. That is true. I mean, Shumlin has been very clear that he supports Sue Minter. He said that he voted for her in the primary. He has donated to her campaign. You know, his business partner and his brother have been donated to Sue Minter's campaign. His staff is helping out Sue Minter. Obviously, this is not a fact that the Minter campaign is highlighting. And you know, obviously, a lot of the RGA ads have been really trying to tag her as Shumlin protege. So yeah, no, I mean, you know, not surprising. He's not all that popular around here.
Tonight, you're going to be co-moderating a U.S. Senate debate. What are you going to ask?
I actually moderated it last night.
Last night, I'm sorry.
That's okay. It was really fascinating debate, so I'm sorry you missed it. You know, what did I ask? We asked a lot of questions. Joe Marone from Vermont PBS was the main moderator. You know, these debates are interesting because they feature not only Patrick Leahy, the incumbent senator, and Republican Scott Milne, but also three perennial candidates, Chris Erickson, Peter Diamandstone, and Jerry Trudell. It's kind of hard to get a really pointed back-and-forth exchange between the major party candidates here. But there's some pretty salty language that gets used. Peter Diamandstone and Chris Erickson seem to be very fond of calling Senator Leahy a war criminal. That was a theme of the night last night. I wouldn't say there was anything that really jumped out at me, frankly, as moving the dial in any direction. You know, I think Leahy was, for a guy who doesn't really want to debate very much, I thought he was pretty strong, and I don't think that his opponents really made much of an impact.
Milne came out the other day with a proposal for term limits. Obviously, term limits are very popular. Congress isn't very popular in the general scheme of things. Any impact this will have, or is this sort of too little too late?
I think it's probably too little too late. I mean, this definitely was a topic of debate last night, and Leahy basically argued, we already have term limits. It's called elections. If people don't like me, they can vote me out. Milne pointed out, well, incumbent U.S. senators almost never lose, which is true. I think that Scott Milne has definitely been making a case against Patrick Leahy that has been very consistent, that he thinks Leahy's been there too long, and that he's controlled by special interests. And he's been making this case for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months. And if you look at the polling, Senator Leahy is crushing him. So, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean that Leahy's got a ton of money and his ads have been effective? Or does it mean that people, you know, maybe they don't want Leahy to serve forever, but they don't see Milne as a better possibility? I don't know what to say, but it's clearly not working. I mean, I think the polls are quite clear about that.
This week we saw layoffs at the Burlington Free Press. 4 people, 3 in the newsroom, and 1, I think, in advertising or elsewhere.
That's right, yep.
What impacts will these have, and is it something that's a trend in the print media?
Well, it's a huge impact, and it's a huge trend. You know, the Burlington Free Press has been laying off its reporters, its editors, for years and years and years. I can't even count the number of layoffs there have been. I thought things maybe had stabilized a little bit. They hadn't had layoffs in a little while, and that seemed promising. They have a number of very strong young reporters. Unfortunately, one of the people who was laid off is one of them, Corey Dawson, who has been reporting from City Hall, and you know, that's going to be a loss. Sally Pollock, another of the reporters laid off, has been there for 25 years. She's just a fantastic writer. She's covered the food scene really well recently. And Lauren Reed, a sports reporter who's been there for 4 years, was laid off. Listen, anytime you lose reporters at a newspaper or at any news organization in a small state like this, we all suffer. You know, less competition is bad for this business. There's no doubt about it. And if you don't have live bodies there in the room when things are happening, making calls, really pressing public officials, it's a problem. It's a problem for democracy. And so I'm really bummed out by this. And you know, unfortunately, this is what's happening in the media, generally speaking, but especially so in sort of print dailies owned by large corporations, mm-hmm. such as Gannett. I mean, this happened because Gannett, you know, not the Burlington Free Press, but Gannett was suffering a revenue downturn and is trying to buy a whole bunch of other newspapers. So they decided to lay off, 2% of their workforce or something like that. You know, and we here in Burlington and Vermont generally suffer when that happens, and it's a real bummer. You know, I would say, just so it's not all bad news, there are some positive signs out there. I mean, if you look at here in Vermont, Anne Galloway, who you just spoke to, she has been expanding her newsroom as some of these corporate entities have been laying off staffers. We at 7 Days have been expanding our newsroom. Vermont Public Radio has been expanding its newsroom over the years. So, you know, there are different models that seem to be surviving better than typical corporate-owned daily print newspapers. And I just hope that it continues. You know, I need a job, right, man?
Lastly, the all-payer waiver was approved by the Green Mountain Care Board, the Vermont Green Mountain Care Board, this week. There's still some controversy around this all-payer waiver, primarily because I don't think a lot of people understand it, or those that understand it have some concerns. Some independent docs have some concerns about this, of what impact this will have on the future. This is going to land in the lap of the next governor. What can we expect here politically?
What all-payer waiver?
What all-payer waiver?
What all-payer waiver? No, I mean, I think that's the issue here, right?
Yeah.
Who knows a thing about it?
That's right.
And you know, I think we've both written about this. This is a really big, complex change in the way that we pay for our healthcare services. And, you know, there's no doubt it's been debated for a long time, sort of at the higher level, between the medical community, the Shumlin administration, the legislature. This has been in the works for 2 years, so you can't really say it snuck up on us. But from the public's perspective, it kind of did. I don't think that it's gotten the media attention that it deserves, and I think part of that is that this was really, you know, the final or the current steps of the process were only really announced in late September, sort of at the height of the campaign season. Both politicians and the public and reporters are all really busy covering these campaigns. So it's been a little bit stealth. Proponents of this say, don't worry, there are many more steps in this process. This is really just sort of the framework. There's a way to pull out of this thing with 180 days notice if the next governor decides he or she does not want to move forward with it. And really a lot of the details of how this is going to work, they're yet to be worked out. And so there will be more debate about that. There's a lot more to be written about this one.
Paul Hines, as always, great job. Thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Paul Hines, 7 Days political editor. Coming up, Alex Apple. We'll talk about some of the poll results, more so with the issues that are important to Vermonters when we return. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Joining us on the line is Alex Apple, WCEX reporter. Good morning, Alex. Alex isn't there. I'm sorry. I thought he was already there, Tom. I appreciate you letting me know here. let's move on. We have Free for All Friday coming up, and I want you to know that it is Free for All Friday is basically where we return over the program to our listeners. So if you have a subject that's on your mind and you think is important, call in and tell us why you think this subject is important. Any subject. That's what Free for All Friday does. We'll do that after we speak with Bob Ney at Talk Media News after the top of the hour. Some of the things, you know, I'm interested in. Scott Milne has come out with a proposal that talks about term limits and whether term limits should be put in place for members of Congress. And as you just heard me, I was speaking with Paul Hines, and he was talking about the fact that that came up in the debate the other night. And certainly what incumbents will say about term limits is that we already have term limits. It's called an election. But to counter that argument, the incumbent, with their ability to raise these large amounts of money, has an enormous advantage over a challenger. Often challengers, you know, they find themselves financially outgunned right from the get-go. And rarely does an incumbent lose a re-election bid. Actually, if you think about this, if this election goes the same way that other elections have gone in Congress, 96% of incumbent members of Congress will be reelected. And yet, the approval rating of Congress is like at 76%. Three-quarters of Americans disapprove of the job that the United States Congress is doing. So, you know, the question of term limits. That will be one of the questions I throw out there. Of course, on Free for All Friday, it's your program, basically. So it's on any subject that you want. You know, the other thing is that we've been talking about the all-payer model. And Paul Hines brought this up. What all-payer model? What all-payer waiver? I mean, there has been, the public really hasn't been engaged in this, and yet it is a fundamental change in how we will deliver health care if it goes in as planned. And the all-payer model is basically a change in how we reimburse our providers, our doctors, our hospitals, in that right now, if you've seen a hospital bill, if you've seen a doctor bill sort of itemized by various items and the doctor gets paid by those itemized items or the hospital gets paid by an itemized item, right now, if we went to an all-payer model, that provider, that doctor, that hospital would get a lump sum to provide healthcare services for patients. And that's a change. And the goal of the all-payer model is to make the payment structure to providers less complex. It does focus on preventative care as well, and that is important. Certainly, you know, a system that's designed in terms of having preventative care, meaning primary care docs, to help reduce chronic diseases like heart disease and diabetes, that will have an impact on future healthcare costs. But guess what? We don't have enough primary care doctors right now. That's a problem in how we're implementing this program. Secondly, the cost estimates, the savings estimates seem out of whack. Matter of fact, not too many people believe them, that we're going to be saving $10 billion over 10 years. And that is a problem that sort of undercuts the model, because the model does have, like I said, does have some advantages. It is, the payment structure is less complex. The preventative care, at least in theory, will help us ease sort of our healthcare costs. And it attempts to ease the administrative burden on providers as well. So in the second hour on Free for All Friday, those are some of the things that I am throwing out there. We can talk about presidential politics. We can talk about state politics. We can talk about all provider model. We can talk about term limits and whether we should have term limits. It's all up to you in terms of what we're talking about out there. You know, there is something I will bring up later as well, and if I don't know if I'm going to have enough time here. I'm trying to search through my stack of material, but I was very interested in a pollster. Pollster did a focus group down in North Carolina, and I was really interested in some of the questions that were asked and some of the responses, and these were late deciding voters in North Carolina. It was a mix of independents, Democrats, and Republicans. And one of the questions that was asked is this: will the next generation be better off? And out of the 12 people, that no one felt that the next generation would be better off. You know, this isn't surprising news since the crash of 2008. Americans have been really leery about the future. So that is a question that I'll throw out there for Free for All Friday. Will the next generation be better off? The other thing is, you know, asked what has been lost in America. And one of the things that surprised me in this focus group was that security for kids seemed to be one of the things that was lost, or one of the things that this group thought was lost in America. So coming up, Bob Ney, Talk Media News, and then Free for All Friday. And of course, if you're listening to this program and you can only listen to parts of it or wish to listen to the whole program, you can always go on to our website at wdevradio.com and click on the Open Mic Podcast. We realize that you have a very busy day and not all of you all the time can listen to Open Mic. I'm hoping that you do, but sometimes you really can't. So click on wdevradio.com and then click on the Open Mic Podcast icon and listen to this program anytime at your convenience. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Hey, we're celebrating a glorious past, but you know what we're celebrating? The future. 85 years, WDEV News Radio. You're listening to WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 98.3 FM from Montpelier. And we're serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Mile and Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. As I said, you can go onto that website and click on the Open Mic Podcast and listen to this program at any time. This is Mike Smith. I'll be right back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Coming up, Bob Ney at Talk Media News, live from D.C., and then Free for All Friday. I've already had some questions come in on the mailbag, and we'll get to those questions in a minute. But I do want to take a moment and talk about Jet Service Envelopes in Barrie. For years, you've been hearing about Jet Service Envelopes just about every place you go. And so if you want a place that it's a great local family business for your printing needs and where they focus on serving you, then you know where to go. That's Jet Service Envelopes. The employees there, you know what they're focused on? They're focused on you. They take great pride in their work, and that pride is reflected in the quality products they produce for you. You want a printer who combines quality, personalized, friendly service, and job dependability? Guess what? It's Friday, so I'm going to do those things. I'm going to stumble over words, and I apologize. But if you want a printer who combines quality, personalized, friendly service, and job dependability, that's Jet Service Envelopes. If you need printing services, whether envelopes, posters, and it's this time of year, Christmas cards or just regular cards, newsletters, brochures, or a magazine or book, Jet Service Envelopes and their sister organizations, Accurate Printing or Spalding Press in Bethel, can meet your needs. Just visit them off Exit 6 on I-89 in Barrie and Spalding Press on Main Street in Bethel during the working hours, 7 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., or email them at info@jetservice-envelope.com. It's my pleasure to welcome to the Open Mic program Bob Ney from Talk Media News. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. Okay, 11 days out. Are you still sticking to your predictions? It's going to be a close election?
Yes. It's going to be close, I think, in the popular vote. The Electoral College is another question, although New Hampshire seems to be tightening. Ohio, Trump is ahead. Indicators say that Florida, he's ahead. Now, he is ahead in Utah, but only because, I think, of that independent. The independent and Hillary are about the same vote, and then that makes Trump ahead by 5 points mm-hmm. in a state where he shouldn't be behind. You know, so that's the problem Trump has.
Yeah, why is that independent really cut into him in Utah? Is
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney has done everything under the sun, everything, to stop Donald Trump. Everything under the sun. And Mitt Romney's from there. He, you know, he hates Donald Trump. He's not going to vote for him. He's did, you know, press conferences against him, et cetera. So that's where I think that stems from, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The WikiLeaks stuff is getting more serious because now even the Washington Post and New York Times are running it. And I say even because they're running the Laureat story, which I first carried 2 months ago on radio.
Well, is this part of David Doug Band's emails that have started coming out?
Right. But Laureat was talked about maybe 60 days ago, and it got no traction where Bill Clinton received $16 million. Now it's getting traction because Doug Band, a longtime White House staffer, confidant of Nixon, I'm so sorry, I did not honestly mean that, of Clinton, ended up forming a company called Tenio, and he had clients like Dow and Coca-Cola, and then they gave to Clinton. You know, it's one of those deals, and that's all in writing now. And so that's what's causing a stir.
What I found fascinating when I was sort of reading this and some of the stories in the major outlets was that Doug Band's emails where he says he needs to connect the fundraising effort with other services like speeches and advice and those sort of things. I immediately leapt to, this is an IRS problem for him, isn't it?
Oh, I would think. I mean, I think if somebody wanted to, if they really, really wanted to, they could right now, forget Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, they could right now pull in Doug Band, Podesta, Uma Abedin especially, and some of the other staffers, at least six or seven staffers, and say, we are going to put you in prison for 45 years. We're giving you no immunity. We want you to talk. Somebody's going to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I know because that's what happened to my staff. They called them in, and even when they would tell them factual things, they would say, we're going to put you in prison for 10 years. How's that? And that's what they do. Then one by one, people start to, you know, get afraid, and that's how it ends up. So this system didn't work that way. I mean, they spent more time interviewing Angelina Jolie about who was on that airplane and what Brad Pitt did, you know, in an anger fit, than they did interviewing Hillary Clinton.
Clinton.
So, you know.
Yeah, it's been reported today, Bob, that Clinton far outpaces Trump in fundraising. Does it make any difference?
No, because this is the strangest thing. If you look at Ohio, let me take Ohio for a second because I know the state well. I'm from there. Ellen's from there. If you look at her organization in here in Ohio, it's breathtaking. It seriously is. They have it down to neighborhoods, people coming in to visit. They've had actresses come into Newark, Ohio, town of 58,000, et cetera. They've got ground troops. They have door-to-door. Trump has virtually nothing compared to Hillary Clinton. I mean, zero. The Clinton ads have been running and running and running forever in the state of Ohio. Trump's ahead of her right now here. Now, more money could be helpful, don't get me wrong. And the Republicans are going to spend more money, but not on Trump. It's going to be down ticket. But it doesn't seem to be the factor. I don't know that Hillary Clinton... How much more can you say about Donald Trump than the Dalai Lama or the Pope has said? How much more can you say, you know? So I think it's come just down to where it's going to be tight, but I think it's come down to where there's a few true independent undecided voters who are disgusted with both of these candidates, and they may vary when they go into the polls. Now, voter turnout is going to be critical because Hillary Clinton, according to what I see, has 75% of the African-American vote. One would think 95 from what you hear, but it's 75. But the voter turnout is what's going to be critical. And if Hillary can't turn out people, you can't buy with money enthusiasm. You can't buy enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. Trump cutting off money to the other Republicans. Now, that hurts in some regards because that's the get-out-the-vote effort that you're doing. Why is he doing that?
Well, this is all disintegrated because Trump now won't have time to, this race is darn near done. and he doesn't have time to do all the fundraisers. You know, he has done more public events, and Hillary has done more fundraisers. That's a fact of life. That's not a bias of my part. That's a fact of life. She's done the traditional, you know, support the rah-rah team, which people do. When I was in Congress, frankly, Mike, I would go to California, Rochester, New York, Pennsylvania, and I would raise money, not for myself. I wouldn't take a dime, but I would raise it for the Republican Party and for members of Congress, right?
Mm-hmm.
We did that. That's what you do. Trump doesn't do that. But Trump and the Republican Party structure have disintegrated with each other. And the Republican Party structure is, you know, Mitch McConnell and Speaker Ryan and the Republican National Committee. And let's face it, that structure disintegrated a long time ago.
And so will that hurt the get-out-the-vote effort down ticket?
I don't think it will, because what they end up doing is save thyself. You know, it always happens with these races like this. Of course, this is the most unusual race in modern American history. Nobody's ever taken it to the depth that, you know, this has been taken to now. So I think local organizations will do their own. They're not going to be dependent on Donald Trump, but it's too late to be dependent on Donald Trump. They've got some of their own resources and are going to spend them on themselves. I just saw a local Republican activist the other day. He's busier than I've ever seen him in the 25 years I've known him. And I've called some of the activists because they feel they're kind of on their own. Mm-hmm. And they have to support their local ticket.
Let's sort of talk about September 9th. If Trump loses...
You mean November.
November.
Okay. I'm having a rough day myself. Listen, the only reason I'm staying employed today is Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
I had to get a column in last night, and I was up quite late. Okay. If Trump loses on November 9th, what will the GOP civil war look like?
Well, now, this is the jackpot question. Whether Trump wins... Okay, let me put it this way. The answer, if Trump wins, what will the GOP civil war look like? If Trump loses, what will the civil war look like? Either way, there's a civil war going to occur. And I don't... The Republican Party on a 1 to 10 is on a 9.5 respirator. The Democratic Party, even if Hillary wins, is going to be on a 6... point respirator. And I say that because the progressives are going to say, we're not taking it anymore, cough up, or we're after you, Hillary. That's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have their own, you know, constraints and kind of maneuvering and change of their paradigm. But the Republicans are in a complete nervous breakdown any way you look at it. And so if Hillary wins, it will do a certain, it will force a certain amount of uniting. Because they've got nowhere to go. If they don't get their act together of what they want to be as a party, and who are they? I've got to throw that out there. Then they're going to be in severe problems. I will predict to you that some of the social issues, if Hillary's elected, some of the social issues will evaporate as far as being a, quote, Republican. And it'll probably gear more towards fiscal issues, probably.
If Hillary loses, does the party immediately go left?
Oh, if you mean the Democratic Party?
Democratic Party.
It has to. It has to go. It has to go left. Now, some people would say, "Well, no, they need to be centrist." Well, look, Hillary Clinton's a centrist. Come on. I mean, we all know that. When people look at Hillary Clinton, they might think not truthful. They might think that she, you know, tells you anything you want to hear. But when you look at Hillary Clinton, she's not Elizabeth Warren taking apart Wall Street. Hillary talks to them for $225,000. Come on, we all know that. She is a more scary hawk to some people on military. You know, she's going to go get Russia. So Hillary Clinton is a pure centrist. She really is. And so if the Democratic Party loses, what, are they going to put somebody up next time more to the right of Hillary? No. They've got to go with a progressive that they get behind. They got the hives with Bernie Sanders. They got afraid with Bernie Sanders. Yet, Bernie wouldn't have had the honesty factor problem that Hillary has. And if they lose, the progressives have to make their move, or there's just going to be centrists elected time after time. And then they'll argue, look, if you'd had a true progressive, this wouldn't have happened.
So we identified one of the people that will come out immediately if Hillary loses. That would be Elizabeth Warren. Let's say if Donald Trump loses, is there a standard bearer that immediately emerges from the GOP?
Well, the one that has the rights to emerge in a political sense and would have the power to emerge would be Mike Pence, because, you know, he's okay. He's kind of being unscathed out of this thing. But immediately it'll go back to the guys that didn't win. And you got Ted Cruz, who pulled the convention thing that I argued ended his presidential career. It did. You don't stand up at the mic and do that. It ended it. And you got John Kasich, who's been defiant to the very end here. So I think he's out of the mix. Then you start to go down. Who do you have? Now, Marco Rubio wins a Senate seat. That'd be interesting.
I was going to ask about that. Is he going to pull it off in Florida?
I think so. I think Rubio will win. He came out really kind of unscathed over the whole Trump thing. He didn't go to the convention and, you know, do what Ted Cruz did, because I was at the convention. That took people's breath away in a negative way. So Rubio is, I think, and this sounds so weird, but I think Rubio could be actually a contender. Pence will have the, quote, inherited right as the, you know, standard bearer.
What about Paul Ryan?
Well, I was just going to say, I don't think for president, but if Hillary Clinton wins, Paul Ryan is the most powerful man in America. If Donald Trump wins, Paul Ryan is the most powerful man in America. Because I think the Senate goes Democratic, and no matter who the president is, because Trump doesn't like Ryan anyway, and Trump will do a different show, but it's going to be up to Paul Ryan if he can hold things together, and he is going to be the player because he controls the House. Depends how he handles it. He could also go down the tubes like John Boehner did.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this, Bob. What was Senator Mark Kirk thinking last night when he said to his opponent, who is Tammy Duckworth, I've forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington. What was he trying to do?
What did he mean by that?
That's what everybody is scratching their heads, wondering what he meant by that.
I don't know what he meant by that. Let me tell you a quick Mark Kirk story though that you'll never see in the media, and I can be called a liar, but there were enough people in the room. Years back, we were ready to go home on recess. Hastert was the speaker. We had our private Republican conference meeting, and Kirk stood up and said, "We can't go home this weekend." And Hastert looked at him and said, "Why?" And he said, "Because we're going to bomb Iran this weekend. We're going to bomb them. We're going to war with Iran this weekend." And we all looked at each other, and we're like, "What? Oh yeah, they have I've got some information. The Pentagon's been doing maneuvers. Yeah, we're going to war this weekend. We have to stay here." And Hastert looked at everybody and said, "Okay, next item. Let's go." And then we went home. Kirk did that in front of all of us. He's a strange guy. I mean, I'm telling you a story that I can be called a liar, but there were enough people in the room. It happened, and he was weird. He would say things. Why would you tell your conference? Now, obviously, we didn't go to war. You know, we came back Monday. We hadn't gone to war. So who knows why he does stuff like that?
Let me ask this last question. What message is Hillary Clinton trying to send when she says that Biden may be the next Secretary of State?
I wondered about that. I don't know. I mean, I guess she's trying to send to the defense world. You know, Biden, by the way, and I dealt with Biden personally. We dealt with him on issues, including Iran issues, when I was in Congress. His staff was remarkable. Joe Biden is a great foreign affairs guy. Great. And everybody knows that Joe Biden's good at foreign affairs. But you don't announce he's in the hunt just because to make people know Joe Biden's great at foreign affairs. You announce it for a reason, and to me, she's kind of sent a message to kind of the status quo military people that, hey, she's going to have a Secretary of State that's not a lefty.
That was it was curious. I was scratching my head on that one when she
That's
sort of,
what I think.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Just like Bill Clinton. If anybody really wants to believe that Bill Clinton slipped and said that health care was a mess 2 weeks ago, does anybody really want to believe he didn't do that intentionally? He did it intentionally. That way, when it turns into the mess, which it has, he says, "Well, I told you so." And then he also sent a message to Bernie's people. Hey, Hillary realizes this is a mess and she's got to do something, you know, because she fought Bernie on taking the system apart and redoing it.
Bob, as always, it's been great. Have a great weekend, Bob.
You too. Thank you.
Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Coming up, it's Free for All Friday. Your calls on any subject that's on your mind. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's Free for All Friday. We'll take your calls on any subject that you wish to talk about. Some of you have emailed me about all payer. What are the downsides? What are the upsides? I'll get to that in a minute, but we can talk about that. We can talk about term limits. Term limits, are they good or are they bad? 76% of Americans disapprove of the job that Congress is doing. And by the way, a vast number of them really, it is 74% would support term limits. Would you support term limits for members of Congress? Tom Licata joined us this week and talked about being a progressive is incompatible with being a constitutionalist. Do you agree or disagree? Of course, we'll talk about the all-payer waiver and the elections. If you want to talk about the elections, give us a call, 802-244-1777, or toll-free at 877-291-8255. I just want to clear up on some of the emails that are coming in. One of the emails asked, well, what are your problems in terms of cost analysis with the all-payer waiver? And here it is. Basically, this. The Governor Peter Shumlin, has said that the all-payer model would save the state $10 billion over 10 years. But if you look at that, and any way you slice it, you can slice it any way, and I'll do several ways just to prove the point. Any way you slice it, those savings are highly suspect. If you try to recreate the way that the governor did it, it seems like he's using a trend analysis to project the state's future health care costs, and then he's saying that the all-payer model will reduce that future trend by nearly half to get to the $10 billion in savings. The problem with that analysis is that the all-payer model only hits only a portion of the state's total health care cost. And therefore, the model's ability to reduce the total cost is minimized. You know, there's other health care costs that are outside of the waiver that have substantial impact on health care costs. Pharma, for example, infrastructure costs, nursing homes, for example. You'd have to reduce those costs substantially to achieve a $10 billion savings over 10 years. Look, will the all-payer model save money? Probably. But the savings is probably going to be far less than what the governor and other people are touting. Unfortunately, and this was my point that I was making, unfortunately, inflating these numbers does take away from some of the benefits that this model has. And this model does have certain benefits that I talked about. That, you know, revamping the way that we pay health care is long overdue. The concept of preventive care is a great concept. And the need to sort of ease the bureaucratic burden on providers is also needed. If you look at it another way in terms of healthcare costs and to achieve the $1 billion over 10 years, about $1 billion a year, by the way, it won't happen in all every year, but to achieve the $1 billion a year, we have a healthcare spend in this, our healthcare economy is 20% of our economy. It's about $6.8 billion in 2017. You would have to achieve a savings of 15% in order to hit the $1 billion a year. If you take out those numbers that aren't hit by this waiver, aren't touched by this waiver, you reduce your spend considerably, and you would have to save 30% in order to hit those numbers. That's why I question the numbers in terms of $10 billion over 10 years. Hope I answered your questions from the person that emailed me. The other issue that I have with the all-payer is this concern with ACOs. If the ACOs, the Accountable Care Organizations, they just can't be another bureaucracy between the provider and the payer. They must be more than that. They must render value-added services for the provider, or else they just become a clog in, you know, another bureaucracy in an already over bureaucratic system. So thank you for your email. I hope I explained. Let's go to the phone line. It's Free for All Friday. Let's go to Forbes. Forbes, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I am fine, thank you.
Could I go back to your prior discussion with Vermont Diggers, ongoing gun battle with EB-5?
Sure.
At what point do campaign contributions cross the borderline and become influential?
I don't know where you're going for it, so
well,
help me out.
I mean, during that EB-5 episode, there were a lot of campaign contributions here in our state.
Surely, yep.
To people who are very much on top of the situation, and we as citizens really don't have the capacity to go up there and oversee these programs. We have to rely upon our elected officials or commissions to look out for our best interests. And taking a look at those contributions and where they went, there's a lot of questions as to whether there was a lot of influence involved there.
Yeah, Forbes, I think there has been a lot of questions. Hopefully the email release, the ultimate email release, because as Ann Galloway said, she was only looking at a small portion of this. A lot of these emails have been on litigation hold. There's no doubt there's been a lot. There were a lot of campaign contributions from Ariel Quiros and others in this EB-5 program. What influence they had, I think we're going to have to wait and see with those emails once they're released. Let's go to Bob in Calais. Bob, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, Mike. Point I just wanted to make on the one-payer waiver. You know, I've listened to your programs. I read Aaron's stuff on Vermont Digger. I've looked at different, articles on it. But no one has a brochure that has a question and answer. You know, like, for example, yesterday, the day before, someone asked, well, I just went on Medicare. How does that impact my supplemental?
Mm-hmm.
What happens when I go out of state, you know, and I get services for 2 months somewhere else? You know, and other questions, how it works. If the care board would put out a brochure, a question and answer brochure, I think it would answer a lot of questions. You know, just gather up the questions and put an answer down.
That's a great idea. Frequently asked questions and those sort of questions about the waiver, put it on their website. Maybe they have it. I haven't looked, but that is a very good suggestion. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pass that on to Al Gobay, the chair of the Green Mountain Care Board.
I would really appreciate it because everybody has questions, all my friends. So I think we need some, you know, just some good information. You know, Medicare, when you go on Medicare, you get all kinds. They have a thing, question and answer, about all the implications, you know, and the prescription D, so on and so on. So that's what I wanted to tell you.
Bob, great, great call. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic. I'm Free for All Friday. It's your subject on anything you want to talk about.
Well, mine's just basically a comment. I think the Clintons are the ultimate players in American greed.
Okay. And you're basing that on what?
I'm basing it on the emails, if the emails are, if the emails prove to be true, and nobody's disputing them now. I mean, you had to pay to play, and it seems to just go on and on and on. And even some of the insiders in the Clinton camp were very worried about this.
Absolutely, Fred. It seems like they were worried about this in terms of what was going on, including, by the way, Chelsea Clinton was, if you read these emails, she was a rock star in saying, what the heck's going on here? It was an interesting read. Let's go to John in Fairfax. John, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hey, how come we're not talking about the overhead aspect of health care? In this country, we're spending like 52% of all our medical dollars are going to overhead, which means it's not going to the patients. We're railing against what doctors are charging us, yet more than half of what we're paying for is for these bureaucrats. And all I hear is we need another ACO, or we need another bureaucracy, we need more of this. When are we going to address the overhead issue of health care? I mean, that's just killing us. Canada spends over 60% on overhead just to get patients in to see a doctor, and we all rail against the doctors. And as far as Hillary Clinton being a centrist, I mean, apparently he missed her speech in Brazil a few months ago where she said our country is capable of handling like 600 million people. We got to get rid of our borders. Borders are hurting the world. We need one world government. That's not a centrist. He spends too much time in the basement of the White House with Obama and that wacky tobacco. So that's my two cents.
Thanks, John, for your call. It's Free for All Friday on Open Mic. We take all your calls that you – it basically is your program. You command what goes on the air here. So if you have an issue, if you want to talk about something, we can talk about term limits. Or actually, Tom Licata yesterday was on explaining his commercial where he basically says being a progressive is incompatible with being a constitutionalist. We can talk about the all-payer waiver. We can talk about term limits if you want. We can talk about the elections. It's up to you. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. We'll take more of your phone calls in just a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. It's Free for All Friday. That means you control the program with your calls. Any call you want, any subject that you want, anything you want to talk about, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. I did get a question that came in on an email that said, why do we need to rush signing this waiver? Now, proponents will contend that it's the election that is causing the rush to sign this waiver, that there's going to be a change at both the federal and state level, and if they wait until after the election to sign this waiver, then it will slow down the momentum on the implementation of the all-payer waiver. And they also contend that this isn't something that should surprise anybody, that the major players in our healthcare system have been involved in the effort for years, that the process has been transparent, and little more is to be gleaned by waiting. But as Bob pointed out, in order for Vermonters to really feel comfortable with the direction the state is headed in healthcare, which, as I mentioned, represents 20% of our economy, the process can't seem to rush. Savings estimates can't seem shoddy. And the all-payer model must be made more understandable to the public. And what Bob talked about, sort of frequently asked questions, is not a bad idea. Because what we don't want to do, and whether you're a proponent or opponent of this, what we don't want to do is have the disastrous results that we had with the Vermont Health Connect. So it's Free for All Friday on Open Mic. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Jack in Bridport. Jack, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Got a couple of things. The other day when you had the spaceman on there, what's his name, Mike Lee?
Lee, that is.
Yeah, and he said he'd been hit in the head with a line drive there back when he was playing ball there and he was in his 20s or something. It sounded to me like he'd been hit quite a few times in the head with a line drive.
Well, Bill certainly... Bill Lee certainly goes to a different beat. I would give you that, Jack.
Yeah. The second thing is, as much as I don't care for Bernie Sanders, when he said the game was rigged against him, he kind of got proven out to be true, wasn't it?
Yeah, if you look at the emails, it certainly there were sort of cahoots between the Clinton administration, the Clinton campaign, and the Democratic National Committee. That's certainly true.
All right. Well, then when Trump says it, everybody goes crazy. But it proved out to be true with Bernie. Couldn't it be true with Trump?
It did with some regards. You know, the difference is that there is real proof with Bernie that he did get sort of shafted with what was going on with the Democratic National Committee. So it is interesting, Jack. Hey, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mike. I have another point I want to make, but you're talking about Bernie. I mean, for me, I'm disappointed in Bernie, and I know my friend is. I mean, Bernie talked about a rigged system, going after the Clintons, a rigged machine. He was right. We didn't know he was so right at the time. But yet, now Bernie's working for the people that he basically had some disgust for. I mean, this isn't what I really call, but I mean, doesn't that kind of alarm people? Was Bernie sincere? Was he genuine? Or is it just like another politician who used some kind of shtick, you know, to get popular with the young people? I don't know.
Do you think, and Bob Ney brought this up, and it's an interesting sort of concept. Do you think that everyone is just sort of holding their powder until after the election, and if Hillary Clinton is elected, the left will exert its power at that point?
I really don't know, but at this point, Bernie had a lot of power. He did get shafted by the Clintons. It's a rigged system, and I think that what we're learning through Bill Inc. It's probably more. It's not just rigged within the confines of the United States, but we got a rigged system reaching out to countries. $12 million from the Moroccan king for 5 minutes with Bill Clinton. I mean, you know, if it walks like a duck. Quacks like a duck, Mike, you know? It's a duck. And then you got Bob Woodward on Fox this past Sunday. Bob Woodward, okay, the Watergate guy who went after corruption and he exposed it. And he just told Wallace this past Sunday that it's corrupt. The Clinton machine, the way it's the grinding and the wheels are kind of coming off that machine a bit. He used the word corrupt, so I think, you know, if Bob Woodward says it, it's just about official, isn't it?
I don't know. You know, Bob Woodward has come out and said some things. You know, it's he's a good reporter. You know, you can take him the way you want to take him, I guess, on that sort of thing. Those sort of comments I hadn't heard. But, you know, Bob Woodward, I give him credit for what he did during the Nixon administration. So, here we are. What do you want to talk about? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. It's open mic and it's free for all Friday. Anything that you want to talk about, we can. We've talked already about the all-payer waiver. We've talked about the national elections in terms of it being rigged. I want to turn to this subject of term limits, because I just find this fascinating in that if you look at the numbers, and I said these earlier, if you look at the numbers, 76.3% of Americans disapprove of the job that the United States Congress is doing. But I'm going to ask this question. Will it change after this election? And the answer is probably not. And the reason is that we elect nearly 96% of incumbent members of Congress. We re-elect them. And aren't these the same politicians that perpetuated gridlock? This election, you know, this has been an interesting election, because this election cycle, it has widened the partisan divide. I mean, our national politics, and in some cases even our state politics, has degraded to the point where it really isn't enough to disagree with an opponent. Instead, that opponent must be destroyed. And in fact, you could make the case that as our country's problems mount, the political bickering and the finger pointing will probably escalate
because it will be nearly impossible to reach compromises or solutions other than temporary or stopgap solutions. Because no one wishes to cede any political ground. It looks like a failure. It looks like a defeat if you cede any political ground. And the American public hasn't missed what's going on in Washington. I mean, 76% disapprove. But also, I found this statistic fascinating. According to a recent Rasmussen poll, and I think it was a couple of days ago, that poll found that 74% of likely voters favored establishing term limits for all members of Congress. Just 13% opposed. Now, as I said before, and you've heard this, incumbent politicians will often argue that term limits are unnecessary because they say the ultimate term limit is an election. But an incumbent has an enormous advantage with their ability to raise large amounts of money. Often, when you have a challenger to members of Congress, they find themselves outgunned from the get-go. And if you look at this, the statistic that I just said, nearly 96% of incumbent members of Congress will be reelected. Those members seldom lose. So will things change in Washington after this election? Yes or no? Give me a call. And this being Free for All Friday, it's any subject you wish to talk about. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Better hurry. We're starting to run out of time. We've got about 3 minutes left. Let's go back to the phone lines. Let's go to George in Berlin. George, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, Mike. Good morning. You know, I think the whole thing with term limits and like Pat Leahy, and then there's a lot of local politicians that have been in forever. You know, everybody sends their kid off to school down in Washington, D.C., and they don't think that their kid, you know, plays bad at school. He comes home and everything's fine. But, you know, obviously there's a problem because we keep electing these good kids and we send them down to Washington, D.C., and then we don't like them when they all get together and do their thing. I think term limits would be a big start. You know, but you have to keep the money out of it that could, you know, just keep continuing the progress and the corruption with the next person that gets into that office.
Thanks, George. Let's go to a call from Burlington. You're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to, I've said it before on your show and I'll say it again. I think term limits would probably make it more vicious, particularly in a two-party system like the one we have. If you have instant runoff voting, it's going to be the only cure, in my opinion, for the problems that we're having in the system. There's just too much reliance on the two-party system. They're too similar, and just ideas that are outside of the box every couple of years or every 4 years sounds like a prescription for success.
Thank you for your phone call. You know, term limits aren't going to be easy. If people want term limits, and we, as I just said on the statistics, 74% of likely voters favor establishing term limits. But guess what? It isn't easy. The U.S. Constitution would have to be amended. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that in order to establish term limits. And guess what? You got for an amendment, it requires a two-thirds supermajority vote of Congress. And then the amendment needs to be ratified by three-fourths of the states. That's 38 out of 50. So term limits are not probably going to be an easy lift. It's going to be a Herculean lift to do term limits. But Americans want them, and we'll see where this goes in the future as we talk about Washington and the stalemates that we have in Washington. Alex Apple has text me. He apologizes profusely. He got tied up and could not be on the show. We'll have him on some other time. But I do want to thank our guests, Ann Galloway from Vermont Digger, Paul Hines from 7 Days, and, of course, Bob Ney from Talk Media News, and, of course, all of you, because Free for All Friday would not be possible without you calling in. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. We're celebrating the future. What a glorious past, but we're looking forward. You're listening to WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. You can go on that website, WDEVradio.com, and click on the Open Mic podcast anytime, listen to any show at your convenience. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls today. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk again on Tuesday.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.